Those of you who are over here in the bullpen in left field, I have some images that you might want to see, so you might want to pull your chairs around, but that is a matter of individual soul liberty, of course, in the Baptist tradition. Thanks so much for inviting me back again to do this. I really enjoy opportunities to meet with the pastors, and I wouldn't be doing what I do if I didn't think I could help pastors pastor. When I was a pastor, I thought becoming a seminary professor was a step down, until it began to occur to me that it wouldn't be a step down if I could still be involved with helping pastors. So that's why I do what I do, and so it's great to have the opportunity to be here again to speak with you today. Just getting invited back somewhere is an amazing thing. You know, you go in, you speak, and they ask you to come back, and it's amazing. Figure, you know, after you laid an egg the last time, probably that's the end of that, but it's great to have the opportunity. I appreciate your concerns and prayers for our school, for Cornerstone University, and for GRTS in particular. Some great things are happening at GRTS as far as our ability to have some outreach to urban pastors in the Grand Rapids, and some amazing folks I've met in that program, and great opportunities there. We're having a conference in March, sponsoring a conference of the Midwestern Evangelical Theological Society. It's March 11 and 12, Friday and Saturday morning. This is a conference that is supposed to be about helping people exegete the Bible more accurately and proclaim it more clearly, more relevantly. So we're trying to let this be known to pastors that professors are saying, look, we need to think about the way we make it clear to the folks in the pews, not just in our ivory towers. So if you have interest in the conference that would deal with that topic, not just accurate exegesis, but relevant application, relevant preaching, we have Tremper Longman coming from Westmont College in California. We have Abraham Kuruvilla from Dallas Seminary coming, and we have a gentleman named Todd Beals, with whom I'm not acquainted, from Western Seminary in Holland, speaking about these kinds of issues. So there'll be, I don't know, generally have around 150 people there for this. We'll have some main plenary sessions with these headliners sharing their expertise with us. But there'll also be probably 40, 50 other presentations being made, some of them in parallel sessions with each other on all different areas of biblical and theological pastoral studies. So if you have interest in that, there is a website, www.ets, or something like that. So if you just Google Midwest Evangelical Theological Society, you'll find out all about it. That's March 11 and 12, and as Batman used to say, be there or be square. Was that? No, it wasn't Batman. He said, next week, same bat time, same bat channel. Who was it who said, be there or be square? I don't know.
Fonzie.
Mr. Fonzarella, in other words. So when Jeff and I talked about what I might be able to speak in a helpful way to you about, we settled on the topic of Matthew 16. I had spoken on this topic, among other things, at a conference last summer of a small group of Sovereign Grace Baptist guys over in Toledo. Have you heard of them, the Sovereign Grace Baptist Association? It's a good group. I wish there were more of them in that good group. But anyway, I want you to know that much of what I'm going to say today, I said to them. And there were no fisticuffs. There was no verbal abuse. But as I did there, I'm also doing here. I have my car right off the side door there, backed into the parking place with the motor running. So in case there's any undue controversy, I'll be able to make a hasty retreat. most of the fruit over there looked too good to throw, so I wouldn't advise anything like that. Save it. It's very delicious, and eat it. So we're trying today to understand how it is that Matthew, of all the Gospels, we're told is the most Jewish, and the one that is the most related to the Old Testament and to the law, and is most concerned to explain to us how Jesus and Moses are connected. How is it that this is the only gospel to mention the church? How can it be that the most Jewish gospel is the gospel which mentions the church, the only one which does, as you know, once here in chapter 16 and once in chapter 18 as well? So that might have something to say to us about the relationship of the kingdom and the church. Since Matthew is well known to be the gospel that stresses the kingdom, using the distinct term kingdom of heaven, it's also the only gospel to mention the church. Is that just a coincidence, or is there something to it? So I'm going to try to work through this material rapidly and give you some food for thought. Hopefully you haven't had too much of the other kind of food, that you're not in a position to receive that here at the moment. And I'm try to leave time for discussion when I get done. What time is this supposed to be concluded?
Usually try to wrap up around 1:30.
Around 1:30, okay. Well, I usually get 75 minutes a shot at the seminary, so just kidding. So we're thinking about the kingdom and the church in Matthew, and the first thing I'd like to think about, I guess, regarding that is that when we think about the Bible as a book, we think about the land in which the book is set. So we'll do a little brief travelogue with you. As you know, it's mentioned in Matthew chapter 16, verse 13, that these things happen in the district or the region, the area of Caesarea Philippi. And then it speaks of how the transfiguration of Jesus in chapter 17 happens in a high mountain. So if you've ever looked at this area, you see that we're way up in the northern part of the land with a north orientation map at the top. Or if we flip the map on the side and do an east orientation, as a lot of really fine Bible atlases are doing today, east orientation in Israel helps you see the lay of the land better, perhaps. We're way up here in the top left corner for where Caesarea Philippi is, sort of on the southern slope of Mount Hermon, which is, as you may know, covered with snow several thousand feet high, often a snow-capped mountain there, as it is in this satellite picture, Caesarea Philippi just at the foot of it. There's a lot of water there. It's one of the sources of the Jordan River. There's several sources of the Jordan River, but it's up in that area where they all begin. So way up in that remote area. If you've ever been on a bus up in there on an Israel trip, anybody? Did the buses up through there? You see some of these roads with these hairpin curves, like right here. It's a pretty cool thing there, don't you think? And this is a picture of the Castle Nimrod, a crusader fort there. I'm not that interested in crusader forts, but it gives you a good idea of the lay of the land. And if you're used to thinking about Israel just in terms of Jerusalem or the Dead Sea or the desert or something like that, you come up into Galilee, and it's a very mountainous area. It's a very fertile area, very lush area. This is a picture of the falls at Beneas. If you ever go to Caesarea Philippi, make sure they drop you off at the Beneas Falls, and then you walk the gorge, the little creek that runs back up to the Caesarea Philippi. It's a great experience. You're sort of walking through a jungle there, and it's a lush area, much unlike what you're used to if you're down further in the south. So Caesarea Philippi was a Roman town. I don't know if all these ruins go back to the time of Jesus and Paul. I think some of them are 2nd century. But there was quite a place there where they worshipped a lot of idols, particularly the god Pan, the god of nature, from which they get the term Beneas Falls. What's Beneas got to do with Pan? You say, well, when you say a B or you say a P, you use your lips to say both of those words, right? So those are really much closer related than you might think. So the thing about Beneas, the thing about Caesarea Philippi, is all the idol niches and things there. A beautiful pillar there in the left center of the screen. Here, much more, you can see how great the work was on that. And you have lots of idol niches carved into the rock there, where various gods, including the god Pan, were worshipped. And over here on the left side of that, you see a big hole in the side, and that's sometimes called the grotto or the cave of Pan. And many people are of the impression that when Jesus spoke of the gates of Hades in Matthew 16, that he was talking about this very place, standing right beside it, pointing to it. The Roman historian Josephus refers to it and says that it was of indescribable depth. You could never get to the bottom of it. But if you go there today, since they had an earthquake fairly recently, there's no water in it anymore. It looks like it's maybe 6-8 feet deep tops. But Josephus says it's very deep, so it must be. So an artist has reconstructed this and attempted to show what it might have looked like basically back in the day of Jesus, in the days of Paul, as a place where idols were worshipped. And of course, the reason why we go into all this is because of the imagery of Matthew 16 about the rock. So here's this huge cliff, and many people were of the impression that Jesus was standing right here, and when he said, "You're Peter," and on this rock, he might have even reached out and put his hand up against it, "I will build my church," something along those lines. But Matthew says it was in the region of Caesarea Philippi. Doesn't say that Jesus was standing by the cave of Pan, you know, or anything like that. So it's an interesting way to illustrate a sermon, perhaps, but I wouldn't die on that hill myself. Perhaps you would choose to, but not me. So from the land of the book, we go to the book of the land. When we look at Matthew 16, verses 13 to 28, it's like two halves, and each of them is shaped like an hourglass, sort of. And if I had more expertise and more time, I would have tried to make a much better visual of it. But what I'm attempting to show you here on this image is that what we have in the chapter is two different occasions where Jesus is teaching the disciples, teaching the group, and Peter, as he often does, as you know, speaks up and sort of interrupts the flow and takes the center stage. And we like to preach about Peter when he does that. You know, this buffoon, Peter, always, you know, speaking before he thinks, you know, foot and mouth disease and all those kinds of sermon things that we say about Peter. But I'm afraid to tell you that when Peter does that stuff, I think the reason why we're told is because Peter is too much like us. So Peter is basically the model disciple. And not only when he stubs his toe and falls, but when he shines as well, in both those times, Peter is really the one who is us. And so we learn from Peter in very clear ways. So if you think of 13 through 20 as one chunk of it, and 21 through 28 as a second chunk, in the middle of each of those chunks, Peter and Jesus are having at it. They're having a conversation. And Peter comes out looking really good the first time, and Peter comes out looking really bad the second time. And when we see Peter looking really good and looking really bad, I hope that we see ourselves looking really good when we focus on who Jesus is, the Christ, the Son of the living God, looking really bad when for a moment we dare think that we can keep Jesus away from the cross. You don't want to get in between a politician and a microphone. You don't want to get in between Jesus and the cross. That's what Peter did here in verses 21 through 28. So I think you have been through this passage before, and I don't want to go into a great deal of, you know, detailed stuff with it, because I think, you know, you could do the same and we would all hear stuff we already knew. So I'm not planning to go like through a verse by verse thing here. But it's interesting to me that when Peter is at the center here, and he does sort of stand up as the spokesperson for the rest of the apostles, Jesus has asked them as a group, "Who do people say that I am?" Then after they give him the rundown of the pop theology on that, in verse 15, notice the text says, "He said to them," plural, them, and "Who do you say that I am?" And that "you" is a y'all, or it's a yous, or it's a yous geist. I was just down in southern Ohio. I'm a Buckeye. See some Michigan colors here today. You know, we could add that to that thing that Paul did in 1 Corinthians 12 and in Galatians about how in Christ there's neither this nor that, but we're all one in him. So that'll work, won't it? Maybe not during football season, but we can have some measure of unity here today, despite that. So Jesus says, who do you guys say that I am? It's important for us to notice that, because Peter speaks up then, as he often does, but Jesus isn't focused on Peter. He's focused on the disciples in general, and Peter sort of, gets into it as the spokesperson. Later on, in the second half of the thing, you'll notice Jesus is once again teaching the disciples. Verse 21, he began to explain to them that he was going to Jerusalem and would suffer and be killed and on the third day be raised. And so he's talking to the group as a whole, right? But here comes Peter, and Peter says, "Whoa, that can't happen. You know, God be merciful to you if you think that should happen. You know, let's go over here and I'll explain to you, Jesus, how this is supposed to be." So it's probably never a good idea to try to straighten Jesus out on things. Even when he says things that seem counterintuitive or outlandish, probably not the best thing to try to, dilute it or change it. Better just let it stand and deal with it. Peter, Turner, and all the rest of us, not a good idea to take Jesus aside to straighten him out, right? Have you tried? I have many times. It's never worked for me either. So this time around, of course, Jesus doesn't commend Peter and doesn't say, "Peter, you nailed that one, and you didn't get it from flesh and blood, but my Heavenly Father showed it to you." This time around, of course, Peter is no longer the foundational stone. Now he is the stumbling block. He's the rock of offense at this point. So Jesus says to him, "Get behind me, Satan. You're a hindrance to me. You're not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of men." Mirror opposite, polar opposite of what he said the last time. "Blessed are you, Peter." Here, in essence, he's saying, "Cursed are you, Peter. Peter, you didn't get this from flesh and blood, but God revealed it to you." Now he's saying, "Peter, you didn't get this from God at all. This is from flesh and blood." I think I mixed that up, didn't I? You knew what I meant?
No.
Did I get it right?
Yeah.
Wow, good for me. So as soon as he gets done rebuking Peter, he's back to talk to the disciples again. So what I'm trying to point out here on the slide is that you have these little inset things where Jesus is getting at Peter both those times, but essentially he's trying to teach the group through Peter, and it's a teachable moment for all the rest of them. Now, what do we know about Peter in Matthew particularly? He's the first disciple Jesus calls, and he's the first disciple in the list of disciples in chapter 10. And his mother-in-law is the first woman whom Jesus heals that we know about. And of course, when Jesus says that he's going to suffer, Peter straightens him out, or tries to, here in chapter 16. And later on, during the Passion Week, when Jesus says, "One of you is going to betray me," Peter says, "Well, even if all the rest of these galoots do, I would never do the thing like that. I'll die for you." So we know that very heart-wrenching story, and we read about Peter there in all of his shame that sort of balances out all the glory that pertained to his other exploits in other parts of the passage. So the thing I'm most interested in here, I guess, is all these verses where Peter speaks up as sort of a representative person. And you see the word sometimes used for Peter that he is the primus inter pares, which just means he's the first amongst equals. But all the apostles are followers of Jesus, part of the inner circle. But when you read the Gospels, Peter seems to be the one who is the center of them. And I know that as Baptists, as super Protestants, or whatever we think of ourselves as Baptists, the other churches stopped reforming before they should have. We kept on and we got it all right. You don't really think that, do you? Or maybe you do. In any event, we think about how Peter is a person who is most often associated with people who don't do church quite like we do, you know, they sprinkle babies and they wear their collars backwards and things like that that we're not into. And so we're Paul people. We're not Peter people, are we? But when you read the Gospels, you haven't heard of Paul yet. And once you hear of Paul in the book of Acts, he ends up getting his affirmation, endorsement from Peter in Acts chapter 15. And give Peter credit when credit is due, right? Paul is having that discussion, debate, whatever you want to call it, about the Gentiles coming into the church. And Peter and he don't have a fight there. They had one in Galatians. I think Galatians happens before Acts 15. What do you think? That's what I think about it. Anybody want to fight about that? But if Galatians happens before Acts 15, then Peter's inconsistency that Paul exposes there has been resolved in Peter's mind. And so when Acts 15, when they have the discussion, what are we going to do with all these, pork chomp and Gentiles? Can they come into the church? Well, yeah, maybe if they become Jews first. And Paul says, nope. God gave them the Spirit. God gave us the Spirit, so they get in. And Peter stood up and said exactly what Paul said in Acts 15. So you think about Peter, the guy is much more prominent perhaps than we would like to give him credit for. So keep that in mind when we think about the exegetical issues pertaining to Matthew 16. And here's where I made sure I had the car running right outside the door. The Reformed guys didn't get mad at me this summer. So now I'm sort of doing a questionnaire type thing, trying to determine whether you get mad at me here today. So we'll see. So when you try to figure out, when Jesus says, "You are Peter, on this rock I will build my church," what did he mean? Well, many people would say, the people who wear their collars backwards, that the rock is Peter, and Peter was the first bishop of Rome, and everybody has to do what the bishop of Rome says. Why? Because the bishop of Rome says everybody's got to do what the bishop of Rome says. So there's not only the view that Peter was the one about whom Jesus was speaking as a rock, but Peter was the first of a succession of apostolic super bishops of Rome, heads of the church, to whom everybody else is accountable. So it's not just that Peter was the rock, but there is a doctrine of apostolic succession that develops from that, and that probably is where I would certainly draw the line. You might have drawn it long before I did. We'll find out in a little bit. So we get away from that view, and people who are Protestants tend to take other views. First one would be that when Jesus said, "On this rock I'll build my church," he was talking about the wise man built his house upon the rock back in chapter 7. You still sing that chorus with the kids in your church? All those good choruses are pretty much forgotten today, I'm afraid. You still do them?
Yep.
Good. Glad to hear that. Things aren't nearly as bad as I thought. Good.
But we're a Bible church, too.
Well, there, figures. So, do you think Jesus, when he said, "On this rock I'll build my church," was thinking about his teaching at the end of the Sermon on the Mount that the wise men built the house upon the rock as opposed to the sand? It's a bit of a stretch to think he's saying, "You're Peter, but remember what I said back in chapter 7 about the wise men built his house upon the rock? Well, on that rock I'll build my church." That's a bit of a whiplash, isn't it? That contextual is a bit too far away, I would think. So although there's some people who take that view, I wouldn't want to go there. You more often hear people say that Jesus was talking about himself. That's the most pious view. How could you deny that? You would be, saying it's not Jesus. Well, Jesus is everything. Well, this isn't Jesus. Well, you know, this sounds like wrong. Everything has to be Jesus, right? But Jesus didn't say he was building on himself. He said he was the builder. So his language would be a bit muddled up here if he's both the builder and the foundation. So it seems to me, at least. So many people have said it isn't Jesus particularly, even though in 1 Corinthians 3, that's how Paul dealt with the image. Many people are saying it's the confession of Peter. It's the apostolic confession. "You're Peter, and upon the rock of what you just said, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. Based on that confession, I will build my church." I think that's getting pretty close to it, but can I split the hair a little bit more? That's what seminary professors do. They split hairs. You'd be disappointed if I didn't split any hairs here today, wouldn't you? I don't think it's the apostolic confession. I think it's the confessing apostle. So yeah, your worst fears are confirmed. He does think that Peter is the rock. And here's where I have to be careful. No one seems to be moving their hand toward any leftovers on the table, or no one appears to be clenching their fists. Anyone that I can see, at least. Some of you have them hidden. So far, so good. So it appears to me that he is speaking to Peter when he says, "You're Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." First of all, I don't think Peter was ever called Peter before this moment. He was called Simon. And references in the Gospels to earlier, before this time, which refer to him as Peter, typically say stuff like, "Simon, who was called Peter." I think when it says that, it's saying Simon, who later came to be known as Peter after Jesus gave him the nickname. "You are rocky, and upon this rock I will build my church." So we not only have a Simon Rocky Barjona, we have a Rocky Balboa who has another movie out, I hear now. I wouldn't go to it. Probably not that good. You know, sequels never really get it right, do you think? I don't know. Movies about boxing couldn't be good, could they? I mean, Paul used it as an image. It's in the Bible, but probably it was a bad idea for Paul, too, don't you think? No, it can't be. Paul did it. Must be right. That's what he told Barnabas, right? "We're not taking Mark on the trip." Oh, yeah, we are. No, we're not. Yeah, we are. This is how we know they were Baptist. So what I'm trying to get at here, then, is Jesus gives Peter a nickname, Rocky, that is worthy of the foundational role that he plays in the church, he along with the other apostles. So Peter's the one who spoke up, and Jesus is speaking directly to him, but he's speaking to Peter as the representative, the spokesperson, unofficial or official, you figure that out. He's the one who always talked for the group, so Jesus is speaking to the group through Peter. He might have said to the other apostles, "You guys are also foundational for the church." So this is not the doctrine that we're used to hearing often in Baptist churches. I realize that, and I don't take it lightly to take a different view of it. I take it very seriously. But I also think that back in the day, there was a fellow named John Broadus who wrote in the American Commentary series. Anybody still have any of those volumes? The American Commentary series. This is back in the late 19th century. John Broadus, by the way, was the father-in-law of the great Greek scholar A.T. Robertson. And he wrote a great book on homiletics, too, that some people might have used back in the day. Nobody used the homiletics book by Broadus. Huh. But you got his commentary on Matthew. Yeah. So here's what he says. Amazing. Peter means rock. The natural interpretation is that on this rock means upon thee, upon you. No other explanation would probably in the present day be attempted, but for the fact that the obvious meaning has been abused by papists. Love that word. Papists. To the support of their theory. But we must not allow the abuse of a truth. In other words, legitimately understanding that in the context Jesus is speaking to Peter as the representative of the other apostles and describing their foundational role in the church. That's what the text says, in my opinion. That's fair. But we can't develop from that an entire doctrine that somehow this brings in Rome and the bishop of Rome, of whom Peter is supposed to have been the first, which may or may not be. I don't know historically about that. What Broadus is saying is that there wouldn't even be a debate about this if it hadn't been already twisted and overstated and become the basis of a lot of unscriptural teachings. We wouldn't even be fighting about this if it hadn't been for the abuse of the text. So do we have to go to the opposite extreme of the Roman Catholics and say Peter is nowhere to be seen here just because some have said Peter is everywhere to be seen here? Perhaps we've done too much of a reaction, and there is some truth in the middle. Peter is the rock of the church. What happened to Peter after this event? Well, he put his foot in his mouth really badly. at the Passion. So God forgot all about him, right? Threw him out. He denied the Lord, so who needs him around anymore, right? Jesus did, because he told the ladies who came to the tomb, go tell Peter and my disciples to meet me in Galilee. Then we bring in John 21. What do you think Peter was saying when he said, I'm going fishing? Did he say, I've had enough of this ministry business, I'm not doing that anymore. I know Jesus called me to be his apostle, but I'm out. I'm just going to go back to fishing now. Do you want to read all that into it? I don't think I would. But however you look at it, Jesus came and broiled the fish there for them and showed them how to really catch fish and got in Peter's face and said, do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? And I don't think he was playing games with agapao and phileo there. I don't believe in any of that. I just think he was saying to Peter, you denied me three times. Now you need to reaffirm me three times, and I will reaffirm you. Shepherd my sheep, take care of my lambs, nurture my flock. So Jesus went and brought Peter back in. And who's preaching on the day of Pentecost? Peter. And who is the one who opened the gospel to the Gentiles, by the way? We usually think Paul did. Not true. Paul most prominently came in later. I know all the epistles that he wrote. I get that. But you go back and read about Peter and Cornelius, right? And Peter had to stand the heat of the day on that one, because the boys from Jerusalem came and said, hey, we heard you went in and you ate with uncircumcised people. What is up with you? You can't be doing that. And he said, whoa, same thing that happened to us back at the beginning, day of Pentecost, happened to them. I was preaching to these raw Gentiles. God gave them the same spirit he gave us. You want me to get in the way of God? Huh, they said. God has given the gift of repentance to the Gentiles too. If Gomer Pyle had been there, he would have said, Shazam! Paul later called it a mystery. Who knew that was going to happen? So Peter is a pretty prominent dude. First and Second Peter in the Bible. You read, been there and read that? Remember how Paul concluded, Peter concluded Second Peter by saying, unstable people pervert Paul's teachings, just like they do the rest of the scriptures. So I think maybe we need to give Peter a little more, cachet. Give him a little more credit. And when we preach about him, not just preach about his foibles, but preach about the good days that he had. And when we preach about his foibles, preach about them as ours and think of him as the representative. So there's one to think about. Another exegetical thing to think about here. When am I supposed to be done? 5 minutes ago? So 1:30, did you say? Okay. We also have debates about what Jesus meant when he spoke about binding and loosing. This is important for our overall topic today, the kingdom and the church, because as you know, after he spoke to them about the binding and loosing, he had previously said, I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Now this has puzzled me for years. Because, I was brought up on the Schofield Reference Bible. I came to know the Lord in a Bible church. Then I went to Cedarville College, became a Baptist. And the Bible church people disowned me, and the Baptists welcomed me. And then I don't know if they did or not. Anyway. So what I was taught was that the kingdom was the millennium, okay? And that was for the Jews. And Jesus couldn't really deal with the Jews and the Gentiles at the same time, so the Gentiles had to be raptured, and then the Jews would come back in during the tribulation, and the millennium, that would be for the Jews, and then for the eternal state, there might be some limited unity between the two, but otherwise, there were essentially two programs, two peoples of God, law and grace, Israel and the church, kingdom is one thing, and church is totally another. I don't get it then why Jesus says in one breath, I will build my church, and in the next, I will give you the keys of the kingdom. The people who taught me the Bible would never have used those words in the same sentence, the same paragraph, or even probably in the same book. Two different deals entirely. Not here. So when we think about the relationship between the kingdom and church, the first thing he talks about is binding and loosing, authority to bind and loose. Lots of people will tell you that has to do with questionable behavior. When the rabbis were trying to interpret the Torah and the Mishnah and in the Talmud, they would talk about binding and loosing as having to do with prohibiting certain ways of living and permitting others. So if something was bound, that means you can't do that. Something was loose, that means that's permissible, you can do that. I don't think that fits the context here. Another idea would be that it's speaking about doctrinal decisions, that certain doctrines are approved and others are rejected. I don't think that fits the context here. Others think it has to do with church discipline, as it does probably in Matthew chapter 18. But Jesus is speaking about the church here, as you can see, as a you know, a very broad, worldwide, I will build my church, you know. Theologians call it the mystical church, the universal church, all these terms that we try to use to describe what Jesus is saying. He's not talking about a particular local congregation here. He seems to be talking about local congregations in chapter 18. So it appears to me that what Jesus is talking about here is entrance into salvation. The kingdom is the sphere of salvation. So I will give you the keys of the kingdom. Whatever you bind will be bound. Whatever you loose will be loosed. Basically, to me, says, whoever you say is in, and whoever you say is out, based on the confession, Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of living God. So we have the opportunity, we have the solemn responsibility, as we serve Christ here in this world, to say to people, based on the authority of Jesus himself, not our own, in whatever words seem appropriate at the moment, that Jesus is the way and there is no other. Whatever we bind will be bound, whatever we loose will be loosed in that proclamation of the gospel. It has to do with entrance into the kingdom, it appears to me. Now, the relationship of the kingdom and the church, that is what I'm supposed to be talking about, and I think there's like 5 minutes to go. So I was schooled in the old line classical dispensationalism. I have an eternal debt to pay to the people who loved me and told me about Jesus and gave me a Scofield Bible, because where would I have been apart from their love? I wouldn't have known the Lord. I wouldn't even have thought of the Bible as one book that needs to be understood in a flowing way. And I have that with me to this day, and I would never get away from that. But I don't think the old line dispensational theory of the kingdom and the church works in this passage or in many others. It all started downhill for me with Law and Grace when I read the book of Deuteronomy. That was a big mistake. You know, I didn't choose you because you were the greatest, but because you were the least. Why did I do it? I don't know, because I loved your ancestors, and I chose them. I thought, that sure sounds like grace to me. Wow. So, that's where it all started downhill. Then I read Ephesians 2, where Paul talked about one promise and how Gentiles could come in and share in the promise made to the Jews. Then I read about the olive tree in Romans 11 and how the wild branches get grafted into the cultivated olive tree. And it all sounded like one program to me, not two different ones. So I don't think the bifurcation works there or in a passage like this. Covenant theology, on the other hand, tells us that it's all like mashed potatoes. You get the church potato, the kingdom potato, throw it in the bowl, turn on the mixer, vroom, and it all becomes the same thing, right? It's all been pureed, if you will. So you're pureeing the Bible. So everything that the Old Testament says about the Jews, you just to say is spiritually true of the church. And that really leaves God's promises to Israel totally in thin air, doesn't it? If God didn't mean what he said to them, and if he doesn't plan to fulfill what he said to them, then I don't know what basis I have to expect them to fulfill anything he said to me. So I don't think we can say Israel and the church are the same either. So when I think about it, what's the relationship between the two, with a lot of kudos to a guy named George Ladd, who wrote some very influential things in my life, I would say the church is the stewarding agency of the kingdom. The kingdom is the reign of God. The church is a human organization that God has chosen to use. That wasn't a very good plan, was it? Peter, people like Peter? If I was going to build a kingdom, I don't think I would build it on the likes of you and me. I said and me, right? You heard that? It's not a very good plan, but it's the plan. So God chose people like us. Paul is amazed at that in 1 Corinthians, the first few chapters, that God would pick us to get the gospel out. But, you know, the power is in the gospel, not in us, right? So the church presently extends the reign of Christ. The kingdom can't be limited to the millennium. God is already ruling through Christ on the throne today. We call him Lord, don't we? That means king, doesn't it, basically? So I think the kingdom is broader than the millennium. It certainly includes it. But there is another chapter in the Bible after Revelation 20, have you noticed? Actually, two more, aren't there? So it doesn't end with the millennium. It was an eternal state. So kingdom and the church. Kingdom is God's reign, God's power, which is already here, particularly after the resurrection, after Easter. There's going to be an even greater manifestation of it in the millennium. To me, the issue with the millennium isn't that it's 1,000 years. I don't think I would die on that hill, but it is future, and it's a more intense method of God reigning on earth than what we see presently. God's going to straighten out the present earth that Adam and Eve messed up. Satan tempted them, they messed up. Jesus is going to reign over the same world that they messed up. That's the only way it makes any sense. Then we have the eternal state in chapter 21 and 22 of Revelation. So, if I were going to, you know, preach this passage, which I sort of guess I've been doing a little bit here today, maybe. I guess not. It seems to me that Jesus is speaking about a cruciform a realism in Matthew 16. There are days when we feel very defeated in ministry. There are days when we feel a bit euphoric. Neither of those feelings are really appropriate, given the focus that we have here in this passage. Jesus is providing for us what I'm calling a realistic, cross-shaped, cruciform view of ministry. When he promises to build the church, we can never have days where we despair and say, I guess things are pretty much over and done with. All the good days are past and gone. All the good times are o'er. It's an old bluegrass song. There's no way that we can think that, because Jesus said he's building his church. My grandfather would have added the expression, come hell or high water, to that. Jesus didn't say that, but that's pretty much what it means. He will build his church. His church, not yours, not mine. We have the privilege to work as under-shepherds for the chief shepherd, the true senior pastor of the church. Don't despair. On the other hand, Jesus gets right in Peter's face and warns him that the moment he takes his eyes off the cross, he becomes a stumbling block, not a foundational rock. So we have no right to get into some sort of a false triumphalistic mentality where we think our latest idea or our latest program or our latest spurt of growth or whatever little trend that we are riding at the moment we think is really doing great for us, it's all good. Pretty soon that's going to come crashing down. Jesus promises and commands us that we should take up the cross. So it's a paradox. I can't say it's a paradox because Jim Greer will come back from glory and tell me you can't say paradox because that's a contradiction. It's a tension. It's a tension. And the tension is the way that we are strong is when we are weak. That's what Paul was talking about in 2 Corinthians 12. The way for us really to have power in ministry and to grow in ministry and to really be confident and truly realistic rather than falsely euphoric is to think about the fact that when Jesus was at his worst, he was at his best. We still come to Jesus with our mother and we say, hey, we'd like a small request. We want to be VP and Secretary of State in the cabinet, right? And Jesus says, not going to happen. That might be how the rulers of the Gentiles do it. Not that way among you. The last shall be first. If you want to rule, then you have to be the servant. And by the way, that's how I'm doing it. Even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, give his life a ransom for many. The earliest version that I can find of the song, Must Jesus Bear the Cross Alone, is a little different. It's, Must Simon Bear the Cross Alone? So thinking about Simon of Cyrene carrying the cross to Calvary. Must Simon bear the cross alone and other saints be free? It's how the song was originally written. It's originally written as a poem, I think. It's been set to different music through the years. Each saint of thine shall find his own, and there is one for me. A little bit different way of putting the song that we still sing. So when we think about cruciformity, that the rule of Christ is perfected when you and I give it up for him and are willing to die, and certainly die to all of our selfish ambitions and put everything we have at the disposal of Jesus on a daily basis, an hourly basis, a minute-by-minute basis. The cross then becomes not just some doctrine that we believe. It's not even some example that we follow. It becomes essentially the air that we breathe, the life that we live is a living death, a dying life. Paul spoke of it in Galatians chapter 2, you know, I'm crucified with Christ, yet I'm alive, yet it's not really me who's alive anymore, but it's Christ who's living in me. I think that's the same thing essentially that Matthew chapter 16 is about. It's about cruciformity.